history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some men and women around you, some seemingly ordinary Americans with extraordinary stories to tell. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that way, boy, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I am in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with a 94-year-old Navy veteran of World War II, and I was struck by the irony as I pulled up to this beautiful retirement facility. They call it Paloma Landing. Paloma is a dove. Landing is something an airplane is supposed to do. But the highlight of Mr. Asbury's story is a plane that came down nothing like a dove and didn't find any land, right?
That's right.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to get that. And his name is, in the Navy records, they list him as Frank Asbury. I understand his given name is Francis, but around here you're just Asbury?
That's right.
How long has that been the case for you?
Well, almost since the day that I was married, because my wife told me I wasn't saintly enough to be called Francis, so she called me Asbury.
I wonder if any other wives have used that line over the years.
I don't know, but it stuck.
That is a great one. Well, I want to hear about your growing up years in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, you had a brother, two boys in the family.
Right.
I've heard a lot of stories about people in Oklahoma during that time period in the Great Depression and how hard that was to deal with. What do you remember about those years?
Well, basically, we didn't have a lot, but also we're really not hurting. I don't ever remember missing a meal or anything, but that's a long time ago.
And did you and Leon get along pretty well, or were you always squabbling?
Oh, no. We were great buddies. We had a really close relationship. We even dated the same girls.
Oh, my goodness. How'd that work?
Well, it was my father's fault. We were sitting at the dinner table one evening, and my dad asked me what I was going to do, and I told him I was going to go to a movie with a young lady, and he asked my brother, and my brother says he didn't have anything to do, and my dad popped off and says, why don't you call Helen and see if she'll go with you? And he did, and she did. And we double dated and went to a movie.
How about that? He was older?
He was 21 months older than I'm.
All right. So he probably showed you the ropes a little bit.
Well, we kind of showed each other.
And do you remember when you were just a boy, did you have some dreams, some ambitions, some thoughts, hey, someday I'm going to do X, Y, Z?
I guess not really. I was kind of a down-home kid and just enjoyed our family and where we lived.
What'd you guys do for fun?
Mainly ice skating. Dancing, enjoy a lot of bands. My brother and I both played football and basketball. He's better at football than I was, but we enjoyed sports. I went to a Holy Family High School.
So when Pearl Harbor happened, were you just out of high school already, or were you still in high school?
I was out 2 years.
Were you already going to college, or what were you doing?
I had a job. I worked for a tool company as a draftsman, and I worked there almost 2 years, and then the war started.
What do you remember about that? Because everybody seems to have a pretty clear memory of December 7th, 1941. You remember how you found out?
Well, yeah, I was driving down 11th Street. There was a young man in uniform hitchhiking, and I picked him up and asked him where he was going and took him to where he was ending up. And I presume that he had been called in. Everybody had been called in at that time. There's training school for pilots, and I think he was in training.
When you heard what had happened there, you know, American territory has been bombed, and now you're at war. How big a shock to the system was that?
That was a huge shock. I couldn't believe anybody would have nerve enough to bomb any part of the USA. And I hope the Japanese Hirohimo, whatever his name is, I hope he's sorry that he did it.
Well, you were part of an effort that I think made him regret that and brought that empire really to its knees over the next few years. When did you decide to join the Navy?
Pretty quick. I had to wait a little while. Needed to get out of my job and whatnot. But my brother went into the Air Corps, but he had to wait 6 months to get called in. I was able to get in the Navy quicker than him. I didn't have a desire to fly at the time, but that's where I ended up, going through radio school and whatnot.
Did you have the idea when you joined the Navy that you were going to be a flyer?
No idea at all.
How'd that all come about?
I just picked randomly, I think, to go to radio school out of boot camp. We didn't request anything. They just told us where we were going to go, and that's what we did.
And meanwhile, your brother Leon is going through pilot training.
He was in several months after I was, but yes.
So I wonder what that was like for your mother.
Well, she wasn't too happy about it, I guess. The worst part about, this is jumping ahead a little bit, the worst part for the family, my mother and dad, was the fact that when we ditched at sea in December of 44, initially they listed us as missing, and then my brother was killed in February of 45. So those are pretty rough times for them.
Unbelievably rough, and there ended up with both sides of the coin, the miraculous survival, and then just a few months later, the tragedy, and we're going to get the details on that. But so as you go through your training, you mentioned radio school. You're learning things like Morse code?
Oh, yeah. You're a dit dot guy.
Uh-huh. Can you still, if you hear some Morse code right now, does it translate immediately for you?
Only thing I know is SOS.
Well, that's a good one to know, especially in your case with what you went through. So was that pretty easy for you? Did it all come pretty naturally?
Yeah, I enjoyed it, and it came pretty easy. I didn't have any trouble with the Morse code. The radio part of it was pretty interesting. Yeah, I kind of enjoyed it.
And before long, you end up as part of a brand new squadron that's going to head to the Pacific, a squadron of B-24s that are Navy planes, and you're a radio man and a gunner on those. So that, you know, initial squadron that you form, as you guys are flying those early missions, how many men were in that crew?
11.
11-man crew. And you were in the top turret.
Top turret, right.
It's pretty much right in the middle of the plane. Mm-hmm. 360-degree view.
Above, nothing below.
Nothing below, yeah. Which maybe is a good thing sometimes.
Well, yeah. Well,
tell me about your first taste of it. What was the first action that you got involved with?
Well, the first time we went to a little island called Canton, and we were going to make runs on Macon and Tarawa, and we had to go to Funafuti to gas up and get bombs because we could not make it to Macon and back to Canton. So we had to do a triangle.
Uh-huh.
We bombed Macon, and then about 2 or 3 weeks later, then we hit Tarawa. And they were both high altitude, 25,000 feet. From there, we went back to Hawaii, and then we turned around and went to Guadalcanal and was based out of there.
So we understand. You mentioned an 11-man crew. You're talking about high altitude bombing, so you're out of the range of those anti-aircraft guns that the Japanese have on those islands, in theory, right?
Well, they were still shooting at us, but they didn't hit us.
Uh-huh. But what's your job during that mission? What are you doing?
Sitting, enjoying it.
Uh-huh.
Looking out for either other planes or if there happened to be fighters around or something.
So if there were fighters, you'd be able to fire at them from that top turret.
Right.
Otherwise, you're on the lookout for them. And are you handling any radio contact?
No, my second radio man is on
at all right.
that time.
Uh-huh. And you are, at this point, I'm trying to think, you're a 20-year-old kid, 21?
Yeah, 20 at that time.
Was that a little nerve-wracking for you?
Well, no, I was too dumb to know any better.
You mentioned what you had to do in those early missions to triangulate to make sure you could land and get fuel. Were there some situations where you weren't sure you guys were going to have enough fuel?
No, we came pretty close, but it wasn't the dire. It wasn't like you thought you were going to ditch. No, we always had pretty much fuel.
And this was VB-106. This is the squadron you were flying with. And this isn't a huge group. I mean, there's only, what, a dozen, 15 bombers or something?
Yeah, we had 15 planes and 18 crews. The whole outfit was probably between 250 and 300 people.
So you get to Guadalcanal basically not long after that island had been taken by the Americans, and then you're flying missions off of that. What kind of missions did you fly from Guadalcanal?
A lot of patrolling, looking for ships and whatnot. We did a little bombing at on Macon and Bougainville, and one before Bougainville, Munda. We just kind of moved up as either the Army or the Marines took an island, then we just moved on up
uh-huh.
with them.
What was the first moment where the reality of this or the gravity of this or the life or death nature of what you were doing kind of hit home for you?
It never really did. You never, or I never wondered when I'm going to get killed or something like that. Like I say, I guess I was too dumb and happy to realize what was going on, and I knew we had to do something, and you just did it.
And how frequently were you guys flying? Was this like a every day, every other day kind of thing?
No, we flew every third day.
Every third day. So what about your downtime on Guadalcanal? What'd you guys do?
Generally, one day you took care of the plane, what had to be done, and the other day you were probably playing cards.
How would you describe the relationship you had with the rest of that crew?
Oh, I think everybody was really very, very compatible.
Did you feel that you could trust those other 10 guys, that if your life depended on it, that they'd be there for you?
Oh, yeah. Everybody knew their job, and they'd all been trained, so you really weren't too worried about it.
In all those missions that you flew out there in the Pacific, did you ever have occasions where you had to use that machine gun in the top turret because there were enemy fighters?
I never did, fortunately.
That's very fortunate, yeah.
We island hopped.
Uh-huh.
I think the first place we went to was Munda, then Bougainville, and then Los Negros, and then we ended up at a little island called Wadki, right off the coast of New Guinea.
Uh-huh.
And that was our last base right there.
And in each of those stops, did you get a chance to experience what was going on or get a feel for what had happened at any of those places, or were you kind of in your own little world?
Basically, I think you were in your own little world. The main thing that you remember and look at the time that you do is the fact that these islands, most of them had palm trees and whatnot, and with the bombing that they had been through, there was very little left of foliage on top of the palm trees, and you knew there was action out there. After we were in New Guinea, a little island called Wadki,
yeah,
we did our last bombing right in there and had bombed that little island before we landed there.
Uh-huh.
But that was our last trip. We came back to the States and had to leave and went up to Hutchinson, Kansas for about 6 weeks. Then went back to San Diego and reformed the squadron. What they did, they took half the squadron and created two new squadrons. And then we went back in September or October of 44.
With new planes, right?
We had new planes, but that was our problem when we went down because we were flying an old B-24 that had a lot of hours on it.
Ah.
And what they were trying to do is to save hours on our new planes.
I'm curious about that leave. You said you went back to Hutchinson, Kansas, and then out to San Diego and all that. Did you get to see your family at all while you were home?
Yeah, had a 30-day leave.
What was that like after all these missions you've flown to go back and see Mom and Dad?
It was pretty nice to see them, and I had a good time. There were still people there that I knew and had young ladies that I had dated, and we made reacquaintances and whatnot. It was a good time.
And did you hear anything about what your brother was up to?
Not at that time. We had corresponded. We had written back and forth.
Uh-huh.
I knew very little of what he was doing, but we kept in contact all the time. Really, when he was killed, my parents did not tell me about it. I was in the hospital and still in there, and my dad wouldn't tell me. And I found out when I came back to San Francisco to the hospital ship, called my folks, and then they told me that was about April, I guess. That's when they told me that he had been killed.
Well, I guess we're going to have to tell everybody what happened to you and why you were in the hospital and all that. When you redeploy, so this is late 1944, and you have to get used to a new kind of airplane, a privateer?
It wasn't bad. It was a neat plane. We liked it.
Yeah, tell us the difference. What was the difference between the B-24s you had been flying and now this new privateer, the PB-4Y2?
Well, the main thing was the flight deck was about 6 feet longer,
uh-huh.
Had more room. And it was a single tail instead of a double tail.
Right.
But still had four engines and whatnot. Also, they had ball turrets on the side, so you were not exposed to the weather as much as in a B-24.
Right, because those would have been open air positions
right,
in a B-24.
And
didn't it extend the range a little bit, too? Didn't they have a greater range than the old B-24?
Probably did.
So you got used to that pretty quick.
Oh, yeah, it was a nice plane.
And your position was no different. You're still in the top turret?
Stayed the same thing.
Still handling radio and machine guns. So where'd you guys go? You were training in Hawaii for a while?
Yeah, that's where we were, and that's where we were flying out of when we were in that B-24 that caught fire.
So what happened? Why were you in a B-24?
To save hours on the new plane.
So these new planes haven't been sent out of Hawaii yet. You guys are just practicing around
the
islands.
Yeah, they're brand new.
You're at Kaneohe?
Uh-huh. Kaneohe Bay.
So you're practicing in those. What was the purpose of you going up in the B-24 that day?
They were doing patrols out of there, so we were just on regular patrol.
Looking for submarines or ships or something?
Ships, mainly.
Do you remember the date?
That we went down? I never forget it.
I didn't think so.
December 19, 1944.
So it's almost Christmas time.
Yeah.
They're probably playing Mele Kalikimaka around the island.
Christmas Day, I had my face operated on.
Yeah, and I want our listeners to understand just how significant this all was. So let's take our first break, and then we'll come back for the whole story. If you want to see what that smiling face looked like before Asbury's life-changing event and what he looks like now, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.